This is General Semantics, October 9, 1963. Along about now, but maybe not today, maybe another time, I want to take time out to share with you the feeling I have about the feelings you must have. We were talking last time about how hard it is to know each other's feelings, but we can have hunches. We can do the best we can to guess. And from what you say, that is, from some of the feedback we get, and from the experience I've had over the years with the course, along about now in the course, there are students who begin to feel vaguely disturbed. And I would like to acknowledge that feeling, to honor it, and to do what I can about it. I think that there is some degree of threat or challenge, depending upon how you want to word it, in the study of your abstracting process. And let me take just a moment to run through some of the reasons which you may be aware of, but it might help a little to have them pointed up so you'll understand why you feel a little disturbed, perhaps. But I think it can be confidently stated in the words of the old Chinese philosopher that this too shall pass. But meantime, you are disturbed, perhaps, some of you. Some of you aren't, and so you won't perhaps feel that what I have to say now is too relevant. The study of abstracting tends to point up the limitations of what you can know, the limitations of the sensory input, of what you can take in, of what you can know, what you can be aware of, what your sensory organ, what the sensory equipment you have in your nervous system can respond to. There's a limitation to what you can know, and so if you have felt, if you have been educated to feel that you must be sure of what you know, this can be disturbing. To deal with what appears to be a fact of limitation in this regard. It points up the limitation in your ability to interpret what you can know, partly through the emphasis that it gives to individual variation in this regard. And it's a great burden to have to deal with the question, which one of us must be right? And it may be upsetting to have to settle for the conviction that maybe none of us are right. It points up the limitations of the language we use, the difficulty that we have in attempting to represent anything that you would call reality or that you would call now nonverbal abstracting. The language is not only limited, the vocabulary is limited, the symbols are limited, the forms are limited. So there is so very, very much to be said, potentially, that we cannot say in the language available to us. This might be disturbing to you if you begin to search the implications of this. And it points up the limitations of our ability to share, to communicate what we know. The sort of thing we were talking about last time, in which we hardly, any more than a very superficial way, sampled last time. Well, now, I think it's understandable that as you come to sense these limitations, you may feel some kind of insecurity in what you have taken to be the great truths by which you have tried to live, or the beliefs which you have entertained, the attitudes that you have grown up with, and so forth. As you begin to ask about these, what do I mean, how secure am I in them, and so on, you may find this a bit upsetting. I want to assure you that I do not want to upset you. I just want to help you to examine the process of abstracting. So we'll be on with this, but I want you to know that I sympathize with you if you find it a bit upsetting. But don't worry about it too much. I don't think you need to. I hope you find that reassuring. Now we'll go on and we'll come back to this if we need to. This diagram is designed to represent another one of the disorders, or if that's too heavy a word, the problems in which we become involved when we abstract in certain ways. I work in a clinic, and people come to me and talk to me about themselves and their problems and their children's problems, and I listen, I try to understand, and I think I observe something that is very important in the language behavior of people under these circumstances. For one thing, their language seems to be vague to a rather high degree. They, at least, as I question, and I think this would hold for anyone who does this type of counseling, as I question a person trying to find out in more detail the what and the where and the when of the story, I observe that the person whom I am questioning begins after a while to show various signs of discomfort. It's hard for him to be precise beyond a certain point. As I question him about his interpretations, his explanations of things, he begins to show signs of discomfort. It's hard for him to explain things differently from the way he's used to. So each one of us seems to talk at a kind of an accustomed level of abstracting. Level of vagueness, we can call it. Now, it isn't just vague. The language is not just vague. Each person seems to tell his story, to talk about his problem in the ways that he can tolerate. We put a light on what we have to say such that we can live with it. We get used to telling the story that way. It's the accustomed way we have of telling it. We've learned to tolerate it in that form. We don't like to change it. Because if we do, then this involves a risk of having to deal with a story that is a little hard to deal with. We're used to the one we tell. So So it's comforting and it tends to be protective. Now, there's something about the language behavior that is perhaps a little more deep than what I just mentioned, which accounts in a way for the vagueness and the self-serving character of the language. The language, the person talks as though he were talking about the realities of the situation. He talks as though he were talking on this low descriptive level. But as you listen carefully, you almost always have to conclude that he's talking on a higher level than that. He's talking on a level of judgment, of classification. He's not being very analytical or descriptive as a rule. He is talking about what things are like, and he is talking in terms of rather large groups or large constellations as a rule. A stutter, for example, tends to talk about the normal speakers as though he were talking not about anybody in particular, with descriptive language, but about a lot of people whom he regards as all alike. The person with a prejudice is not talking about any individual Negro or Catholic or Jew or Mexican. He's talking about all those people. You know how they're, what they're like. As though they were all alike and he isn't interested in any one of them. So he's not talking a descriptive language about any particular person. He's talking about the Negro or the Catholic or the Jew inside his head, but not about the Catholics or the Jews or the Negroes or the Mexicans or the Yugoslavs outside his head. Here on the nonverbal levels, the realities, these he doesn't talk about much. Almost never does he make a statement that appears to be about any one of them. He is talking about something inside his head, a category that he has made up and that he lives with, that he thinks with. The person who has a fear of audiences, we call it stage fright, hardly ever talks about a specific audience or a specific experience. He may talk about one which he says was the beginning of it, but now he talks about all other audiences as though they were like that one. If he talks about that one at all, he may just talk about audiences. So that the language is not only vague, and he doesn't only make the kinds of statements about audiences, for example, that he is able to live with, but he talks about audiences as though he were talking about actuality, in some sense. And the important thing is that he gives no evidence that he knows the difference. And this is what we mean again by the identification of levels of abstraction, of different levels, as though they were the same. As though he were not making this distinction between the language of classification and the language of description, the language of judgment, the language which is necessarily referring to something inside his head, always, as against the language which refers, to some degree at least, to something outside. This is the great fault, it seems to me. Now, what we mean by education, what we mean by an attempt to make people more understanding if they have prejudices, what we mean by trying to make people achieve better adjustment if they have personal problems, pretty much can be talked about in terms of helping the individual to get down out of this, what I call his verbal nest. To get down out of it, on to the ground, as it were, to re-examine the facts that he talks about in his accustomed way, to be more specific and more detailed and more accurate and more relevant, so that then he can get back up to higher levels to reinterpret. So he comes out of the education or the therapy or counseling, not only with new information, but with new attitudes and feelings about this information, with new interpretations of it. I call this behavior, I call it verbal nesting for another reason, and that is that the person nests in this verbal world he makes, ordinarily not just by himself. He shares this verbal nest with any others with whom he may share his more important feelings and judgments. People usually share their prejudices and their fears and attitudes with others, and it is a kind of a nesting in that sense. This is something that people do together, the individual does with others. Now I want to try to bring some order out of what may still be some chaos by talking about, could we have the next slide, Augie, please, by talking about some rather general principles, if you can see them. Can you read that? That's better, isn't it? Non-identity, non-wholeness, self-reflexiveness. Basic premises. Can you read it? Well, if you can make it out now that I have told you what it is, I'll turn the lights back on so you can be writing if you want to. We can sum up a good deal of what we've been talking about by saying that the process of abstracting appears to involve, when it is carried on without blockages and without snarlings and confusions, and appears to involve the non-identification of one level with another. It appears to involve an adequate differentiation among the levels. You do distinguish between what you can see and what you can imagine. what you can observe and what you can only talk about, or what you do talk about, what you say. And on the verbal levels, there are distinctions to be made between description and classification or judgment, evaluation, in terms of placing things into categories that we call good and bad, desired or undesired, and explanation. And so we can reduce this to a premise of non-identity. This in no way negates anything that you want to do with the Aristotelian principle of identity in playing the game, which is called Aristotelian logic. Just don't confuse it with talking about reality. A is A, so long as you're playing that game. But it's a game. In the meantime, no two A's are alike on the verbal on the nonverbal level. We can talk as though they were, and we can say a great deal this way. It might be significant one way or another. But it's rather hazardous to forget what we're doing when we do it. This means, then, that there is a non-allness kind of character to abstracting at any given moment. You're not done yet. There's always another level to go to, if you will. You can always abstract from your last abstraction. You can always evaluate your last evaluation. Comment about your last comment. You can always revise your last revision. There is no end to abstracting. And so anyone who talks as though the data were all in and he were done abstracting is abstracting in a way which violates the non-allness principle, premise. And so everything then must end with etc. Now, your English teacher, bless her, may have told you never to use etc. That implied a kind of laziness. Go ahead and think, what is the word you want to use? Don't just say etc. Well, there's some justification for that, I think, in most of the writing you would be doing, or in most of the speaking. And anyway, I'm not talking about actually using the word etc. It's always implied, that's all I mean. Even though you do finish the sentence and you put a period there to be conventional, there's an etc. there by implication. We understand this. We know we haven't really put a period to anything except a conventional sentence, just to be conventional. We're not really finished, so there's always an etc. implied. The self-reflexiveness is the hopeful part of all this. What you say affects what you say next. Your language is affected by itself. This can of worms sort of character to your language is summed up in this word, self-reflexiveness. That is, it acts upon itself. It reflects itself, if you like. You can word this almost any way you want to, and you will be more or less right in what you are trying to say. There's an interaction of the language part by part with itself. in terms of the levels of abstracting, what you observe on the lensing level will determine what you observe on the non-lensing level. What you observe at all affects what you will say. And what you say in turn affects what you observe. This means that you can correct your mistakes. This takes an awful lot of the tension off from the accustomed pressure we're under to be right. If you're not right, that's all right. You can correct it next time around, as it were. There's a kind of, it's all a matter of approximation anyway. You're doing the best you can, and from somebody's point of view, you may be wrong. Well, from somebody's point of view, maybe from your point of view, 5 minutes later, all right, so you can correct it. The process is self-reflexive. It enables you then to revise. Let's have the next slide, Augie. Now we can talk about abstracting. You read that a little better. As summarizing a process that is, as I say in the book, a process of leaving out details, summarizing, continuously going from level to level as you leave out details, as you go from level to level continuously, you leave out details so that you don't, you tend to give attention at the highest levels of verbal abstracting where you are explaining, you give greater attention to the invariance, as we call them, the constants, the factors that the various elements of a situation appear to have in common, and the relationship among those. As we go to lower levels, we pay more attention to specific details in them themselves. So you can talk about abstracting as a process of summarizing continuously by going from level to level in a self-reflexive way, and so multi-ordinally, meaning this is a fancy word for saying that there are many, many levels or orders of abstracting. Orders here is used synonymously with the word levels. Orders of abstracting. Multi-ordinal is the same, it means the same thing as multi-level. And so, the most important implication of this, I think, as a rule, has to do with the multi-ordinality or the multi-levelality of the meanings of words. That is, words can be said to be multi-ordinal with respect to meanings. The word yes can be used on any level, any verbal level of abstracting. But the higher you go, the more you're saying with it, the more you're agreeing to. With this in mind, with the multi-ordinality of meaning in mind, you can say things like, for example, always and never are two words that you should always remember never to use. You are playing up and down the levels of abstracting when you say things like this. You would probably not say always on a low descriptive level of abstracting. It would be very rare that something would always be true of all instances. But in general, it can sometimes be said that something is always true on the average. If you get a sufficiently lively sense of the multi-ordinality of meanings of common words, you, by doing this, you increase your vocabulary enormously. How many thousand words do you know? What's this mean? What level are you talking about? Not only what do you know by know a word, but on what level can you use these words? On what level can you talk about relationships among persons, for example? Think of this in terms of just ordinary summarizing or generalizing or grouping. You can talk about relationships between individuals. You can say that Joe and Mary like each other, right? And you can go to higher levels and talk about whole nations. You can say that, for instance, France and England hate each other. Well, this is getting pretty abstract. But you can say it. But the word like means something entirely different at that level, or the word hate. And if you can use the word on both levels very well, you know more words than if you could use the word only on one level but not the other. In this sense, then, you can increase your vocabulary enormously, let's say indefinitely. And you can make the language, therefore, for you, more adequate. Its potential for differentiation becomes greater. You're using the same language to an outsider who doesn't know about abstracting. But to you who does know about abstracting, who do know, and who are conscious of the multi-ordinality of language, you know that you are doing a better job of attempting to represent what you call the facts of your first-order experiences in the sentences which you form about them. Panel, have anything to say to me? Let me ask you something, because this might be helpful to all of us. First of all, how do I ask it? Do you follow me when I talk about multi-ordinality? Is this, I realize that you may follow me more or less, you have some vagueness about it, and you will be reading about it the rest of your life, but you know in general what I'm talking about. Is this something which seems to you to have any of the qualities of a new idea, novelty? Have you thought of your vocabulary in this way as consisting perhaps of potentially millions of words, provided you differentiate not just the ordinary dictionary meanings of words, but in terms of the levels of abstracting on which you use them. We were talking the last time, for example, about love. Here's a word that causes, obviously, tremendous confusion. And this is serious, I think. It would be tremendously advantageous to learn to use this word more adroitly. It obviously means something different on higher levels of abstraction in general. You can love mankind, perhaps, more easily than you can love Joe Brown. At least if you love mankind and you love Joe Brown, you're doing two different things. The word means two different things. And love, you say that you love Joe Brown under certain circumstances, when he is no kith or kin of yours. This means one thing. It means something else when he's your favorite cousin or your younger brother. And so on, and so on, and so on. It's certainly true that love is a many splendid thing. It is far more splendid than the song or the play makes it out to be. It means, in a word, love is a multi-ordinal term. You had your hand up, Gerald.
What good
I'm glad you added that last, because you do tend to take on a whole new set of problems any time that you learn something that most other people don't know. If you study medicine, you're going to take on a whole new set of problems which you will have in talking to people who don't know medicine the way you know it. When you study language, the same thing happens.
That seems to be one of the basic problems of science, is defining terms. Just like leader of research.
It would be easier to do if all the readers was sensitive to the multi-ordinality of the terms we're trying to define. I don't suppose most readers would quite know on what level the word electron was being used in a given sentence. It would help if they did. Well, we don't need to worry too much, I suppose. I mean, we can worry about words like that, but I'm much more concerned about ordinary words, little ones like is and I. What do you mean when you say I? I am the shy type. What's I? Where am I talking? What level? You immediately begin to realize what this means when you ask, I when, where, doing what, with whom, and what do you mean by shy? When, what is it, what would you observe if you observed it, etc. And when we say things like this, we usually, I think, don't quite understand, or don't understand well enough the difference that it would make if we were to take due account of the level on which we're speaking, the relative level. If we knew how to go up or down from that point, we would be using language more adroitly, more effectively. Let's have the next slide. Principles, rules, premises. These words are big words. These are certainly not ordinal terms. But they are being used here to name categories, to indicate some general levels, levels of generalization. Principles of probability, conditionality, and extensionality. We can organize a good deal of what we have to say about abstracting in terms of these principles. The process of abstracting is a personal affair. You do your own, I do mine. Each person does his own abstracting. This is a neurophysiological process. It goes on inside organisms. So far as abstractions, therefore, are the product of organisms, and if we may assume there is no one organism who is the master organism, whose abstractions we are all to accept and model after, and if we further assume that any organism in abstracting is affected by the conditions under which he's abstracting, everything from temperature and what he's just eaten and what the psychologists call motivation and information, etc., then we're always dealing not with certainties in any absolute sense, but probabilities of some degree. What we say is probably true in some degree of probability. You can become very mathematical about this and talk in terms of probability theory as the statistician does, and be very, very precise about it, and very cautious in accepting generalizations, rejecting all those that you cannot accept at the 1% level, as a statistician would say. If you did this, you would never bet on a horse race, and you would never fall in love, that's for sure. Or you can just operate with this notion of probability in what we would call a common sense fashion, in an ordinary way, and you don't try to state the probabilities exactly. You simply have a relative sense of what is more or less likely to be dependable. Now, I think I observe in the clinic that a good deal of the discomfort, the maladjustment of people who say they have problems can be traced, in part at least, to a kind of a quest for certainty, a sort of a rejection, although they wouldn't usually be able to verbalize it that way, a rejection of the probability notion. Much of what you read in the papers these days about the smoking and cancer argument reflects this. Much of what has been stated by the researchers is rejected by someone or other with the statement, well, they're not really sure, it's just statistical. It's just probably the case. And this seems to me to reflect a kind of naive assumption that you can have something better than a high order of probability. All you have to deal with, as far as I know, are probabilities at any given moment. Because of the nature, the abstract and personal. I don't know whether I have made this clear enough to satisfy each of you or not. In teaching a course like this, it seems to me we have to go by a series of approximations. You can say just so much in 50 minutes. And I can say what I have to say just so well and no better. And you can interpret it just so well and no better. And so we do the best we can. Now, in 2 minutes then, we'll do the best we can with the notion of conditionality. Whether or not what you say is dependable or true, and to what degree it is probably true or dependable, depends on the conditions under which you're talking, or under which you made the observations about which you're talking. And this has something to do then with behavior. Whether you respond to a word, say, in a certain way will depend upon the conditions under which you are confronted with it. I think there is something peculiarly significant, revealing of our culture, even in some of its more scientific aspects, in the lie detector phenomenon. The person who responds to the word, any word, that I'm talking now about the free association test, the word association test, which we respond to the word blue in a certain way. Out of context, what is it to respond to under those conditions? If you were sufficiently aware of abstracting, you would ask, what blue? Blue what? Doing what with it? For what reason? With what effects? Now ask me how I react to blue. I think there's a good deal of this unconditionality in our reactions to appearances, to what we call, for example, feminine beauty, or to style. What is a good-looking hat this year? You show me a hat and you ask me, for instance, do I like it? What are you going to do with it? Who else, what are the other women going to be wearing? Are you going to a ball game or to a formal party? Don't ask me how I like the hat. I don't like the hat. I don't like the hat.